Management, International Studies and Leadership, both from the University of Melbourne. Her interests include global justice, digital innovation, entrepreneurship, and practices that drive rapid transformation. She lives in Melbourne, is married with two children, and attends St Jude's Carlton. Ladies and gentlemen, let me introduce to you Claire Rogers.
Well, good morning. Thank you. Small technical problem there. It's wonderful to be here in Tasmania, one of the most beautiful places in the world. It's a place where I've always wanted to spend more time. After a gorgeous holiday I spent hitchhiking, yes, you used to be able to do that, here between school and university. And I was remembering we also rented a car from Rent-A-Bomb and chuffed around Tasmania in a mustard-coloured VW, which was pretty exciting, and putt-putted our way up to Cradle Mountain and beyond. I'd like to begin by telling you a bit about the wild ride that I've been on over the past 18 months. As Stephen said, 2 years ago, I was head of digital banking at ANZ, and now I'm the CEO of World Vision, Australia's largest humanitarian agency. I wasn't looking for a new job, but when I was asked to consider becoming the next CEO and to bring my digital expertise to that context, I decided to embrace the opportunity. I became, although I didn't know it at the time, the first female CEO. Gender has been part of my story. When I started out in the finance sector, I was so often the only woman in a room full of men. Now, in my current role, it's become a daily joy to champion the world's most vulnerable women and girls, because they have a key role to play in the future of our planet. I've always loved a challenge. It's been a defining characteristic of my career. But it's fair to say that 18 months ago, I had only a vague idea of what I was getting into. It's been an astonishing journey from one sector to another. I've gone from a high-end corporate environment, wearing suits and heels, to sitting barefoot on the ground among Samburu women in Kenya. In fact, they dressed me and almost smothered me with their love and generosity. So it's been thrilling. It's been disturbing, sometimes heartbreaking. It's been inspiring. It's been a journey into places that I only knew secondhand. Like many of you, I sponsored a child. Like many of you, I donated regularly to charities. Then suddenly, I found myself in a role that has required more of me and forced me to examine my personal commitment to social justice. You are looking at someone whose moral universe has been shaken to its core by seeing World Vision's work with the world's most vulnerable people. As a Christian, I've needed to look to Christ as never before. By any measure, he is one of the world's greatest humanitarians. In the Sermon on the Mount, he says, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after justice." Back in Christ's day, those who thirsted for justice most were usually those on the margins. Some things haven't changed. It's my turn to pay deeper attention to those in need, to put the skills I have spent my life acquiring into a new service. Christ's call to love our neighbour as ourselves is always on my mind. I have come face to face with poverty and displacement as never before. But while it can be overwhelming, there is actually some good news. And this is not talked about very much. In the last 15 years, deaths of children less than 5 years old have halved from 30,000 to 15,000 a day. And that's through the work of World Vision and other humanitarian organisations. Since 1990, nearly 1.1 billion people have come out of extreme poverty. In fact, our most recent data shows that people living below the international poverty line has reduced to 700 million. That's only 10% of the global population. But it's still too many. We know that 2.1 billion people still lack safe drinking water at home, an issue World Vision is working hard to address, reaching one new person with clean water every 10 seconds. The progress we've made, these statistics encourage me every day. The world is getting better, but it's still not good enough. And that inspires me to lead an organisation to be a window through which the transformative nature of our work is made real to all Australians, that they might join us in making the world a fairer place, starting with the children. This journey has also caused me to reflect on the nature of my own privilege. I believe that we, the political leaders and Christian leaders in this room, all share something: the desire to leave the world in a better place. The faith we share asks us to believe in and advocate for the equal rights and freedoms for all. Equality is a fundamental value for all of us, both personally and professionally. We are among the privileged by virtue of being in this room, which gives us access to agency to improve equality. Tasmania is in good shape economically. It's a good place to live. Tasmania holds a magical place in the psyche of most Australians, with its beautiful forests, quiet mountains and stunning coastlines. Compared to a world full of turmoil, this is a place of peace. Our relative security in Australia gives us a privileged perspective. Recently, I was listening to a talk by the American pastor, Reverend Ashley Matthews. She recast the human story from Genesis in such a beautiful way that I'm going to have to quote from her directly. She says that the first humans were told by God that everything from the least of things to the greatest of things had a right to flourish, and defending this right would be the proud work of the human, and they would call this work justice. But then something went terribly wrong, and rather than using our privilege to call out and cultivate potential in all things, we began instead to use our privilege to dominate those who are different from us, and to exploit weaknesses. And privilege subsequently became more of a right than a responsibility. And women went from standing beside their partners as equals to standing behind their patriarchs as inferiors. And in like manner, all of our isms were born: sexism, racism, classism, and they called the work sin. Reverend Matthews goes on to describe how this led to the need to make right everything that sin had made wrong. And an important aspect of that was restoring to their rightful place all those who had lost their place through domination and exploitation. We know who these people are. The women, the sick, the old, the unwanted, the outsiders, the homeless, the refugees, those on the highways and the byways. This is part of the work of redemption. Much of what Reverend Matthew said resonated deeply with me. Firstly, because calling out and cultivating potential in young leaders, especially women and girls, is a cause very close to my heart. She also made me reflect on what my personal privilege really means and what I could do with it. I've thought a lot about privilege being a responsibility and not a right. I am a very privileged individual. I have loving parents. I am white. I am educated. I live in a nice suburb close to the city of Melbourne, not as good as Tasmania, but it's very nice. I've had an interesting career. I've raised two children in safety. I've been protected and sheltered, and I don't have to face what 68 million displaced people are facing around the world right now. Most of us here don't know what it's like to be on the run. We don't know what it's like to face trouble giving birth in a tent without a doctor on standby. I had birth difficulties. If I had been in that situation, I wouldn't be here right now. My baby son and I would have died. Most of us don't know what it's like to be forced into a dangerous situation or a dangerous decision that we don't want to make. Like trusting the lives of our loved ones to a leaky boat and a people smuggler, because if we stay at home, we will be killed. I can tell you that if it came to protecting my family, I would do anything it took to save them. Put to the test, I suspect that's true of most of us. Or in the words of Numa Touré, a 17-year-old refugee from Gambia, I knew the journey would be dangerous, but if you have the lion behind you and the sea in front of you, you take the sea. I was 100% certain to die at home and thought I had a 50-50 chance to survive the sea. Do we really believe in equality? I'm not talking here of intrinsic differences and ethnic distinctions. I'm talking about the idea that every human being made in the image of God should be able to access the same rights and freedoms. And if the answer to that is yes, we believe in the principle of equality, then how does this principle really shape our behaviours and policies? Because if displaced people are our inferiors in practice, and this is what Reverend Ashley Matthews has been calling out, if displaced people are our inferiors in practice, we can't then say with integrity that they are our equals. This is simply a fact. The goal is not to declare that we are not sexist or not racist or that we believe in equality. The burning question is, are we willing to use our privilege to ensure equality? Before coming to this role, I was aware through my work in digital transformation that the 21st century has brought us all into the age of the global community. Sorry, Tasmanians, there's a world out there beyond Tasmania. With more than 75 billion devices coming online by 2020, we are more connected than ever before. What this new job is making me more aware of is the seismic nature of this new era of understanding ourselves and the planet. Throughout most of human history, we have solved our problems locally. But now, global problems, you know what they are, terrorism, pandemics, refugees and displacement, climate change and poverty, require global solutions. We must work together. We know this, but sometimes it's hard to see how this is going to unfold, especially in our current environment of a general backlash against globalism, with talk of religious freedoms being challenged, walls being built, aid budgets being cut, agreements being withdrawn from, and detaining refugee children accepted. And even open hate speech against people of different faiths and backgrounds. Like many Australians, I'm used to thinking of us as a generous and outward-looking nation. We are in the middle of a great test of our national character. On Monday, just 2 days ago, World Vision launched an advocacy campaign along with the Australian Refugee Council, Oxfam and others to get the children currently detained on Nauru resettled. We want to see the children and their families brought here or resettled in a suitable third country that welcomes them, where they can build a real future. We've given our political leaders till Universal Children's Day on November 20 to do something. And why have we started the clock? Because the children are suffering. Child rights is what World Vision is all about. As a child-focused organisation, the issue of children in detention anywhere in the world is an ongoing concern for us. Our international efforts focus on ensuring all children's rights are protected, wherever they are. For example, right now, World Vision has a global campaign, It Takes a World, with the goal of eradicating violence against children in every country where we work. It's ambitious, but aiming for goals like this is in World Vision's DNA. In my travels over the past 2 years, I have seen firsthand how vulnerable children can be, especially in the fragile contexts in the world. Places like Bangladesh, where the Rohingyas have been pushed across the border from Myanmar, or South Sudan. I've been to the refugee camps in Uganda and Cox's Bazar and met and talked with children and their parents and children who have no parents, who fled terrible violence and suffered great loss. A lot of our work in these camps consists of very basic child protection. We create safe places for children where they can simply play without fear for a few hours a day. Children sometimes come in unable to speak, and after some time, a couple of weeks just being in a space where it's okay to be a child, they will start to speak again. So having seen all that, it was very shocking for me to come home from visiting Cox's Bazar earlier this year and soon after to realise that my own country was still actively and systemically denying children's rights. A brave and determined Australian primary school teacher, Gabby Sutherland, held up a photograph on Q&A taken that day of 124 children still being held on Nauru. For some time now, the government has been insisting that there are no longer any children in detention. Clearly, the government is relying on semantics, because here was a photo of 124 children still clearly trapped on Nauru. I haven't been to Nauru. Few people have. But I've seen firsthand the plight of children growing up in refugee camps. Hope is a universal gift that Jesus gave us. How we treat other human beings can give or take away hope. people, let alone children, who are our future leaders, should not be left in limbo for prolonged periods. There is no hope when there is no end in sight. There is actually nothing that can justify the imprisonment of innocent children, anywhere, anytime. So I wrote a piece that ran in Mamma Mia, expressing how shocked and heartbroken I was. In it, I said, as CEO of World Vision Australia, I am leading our efforts to ensure the rights of children are recognised and upheld across the globe. The last place I expected to have to wage this battle is in my own country. With our First Nations children and the refugees we are detaining on Nauru, I have a job to do. You don't need a fence to detain a child. Think about this. You remove a family's liberty. You put them on a phosphate rock the size of Melbourne Airport in a community that didn't ask to have them. You tell them nothing about their future for 5 years or more. You refer to the family or the child by their boat number. So often, they start to refer to themselves by this too. You prohibit them from working for 4 years, and then you change your mind and expect them to get a job in a community with only 12,000 people. You provide little social and medical support, such that the parents become depressed and can no longer look after their children, robbing them of their capacity to be the role models their children so desperately need. In so doing, you remove all hope from the family. All the while, the children are watching their parents' distress and that of the other adults around them. All they have known from a young age is the world of fences, security guards, and uncertainty. They are witnesses to and sometimes part of protests. They see desperate acts of self-harm, like lip stitching, and even people setting themselves on fire. Some of the children choose to control the only thing they can. They refuse to eat, drink, talk, and walk. So no, you don't need a fence to detain a child. We've put these children in a psychological cave, but there's no team of rescuers coming to save them, unlike the football team in Thailand. So we're calling on Australian Parliament to assemble the rescue team. It is what we do brilliantly as a nation. We're calling on our political leaders to do what they do best. Bring these children here to Australia or a third country that welcomes them by Universal Children's Day. The Australian Parliament have found outcomes for thousands of refugees so far, and we applaud that. But these children, through no fault of their own, have drawn the short straw to be in the last cohorts. They are unfairly being used as a deterrent. 40 of them have never known another life. They were born in detention. Every day this is not resolved, more damage is being done. Rehabilitation is urgent. If we don't take action, and it's not just me saying this, there may be a child who dies. We call Nauru a refugee processing centre, but there is no processing going on, or at best, it's vastly inadequate. And the number of children on Nauru is reducing, but only for the worst possible reasons. A 10-year-old boy's repeated attempts to commit suicide. A teenage girl's refusal to talk, eat, drink and walk, something they call resignation syndrome, resigning from life. A very ill toddler sent first to Port Moresby to sustain our commitment that none of these refugees ever come to Australia. But the care was inadequate, which had to be overruled in the courts. And just yesterday, another child was medi-evacuated in an urgent situation. We have been embroiled in a toxic debate on refugees since the Tampa crisis in 2001. Our domestic rhetoric has demonised asylum seekers. In recent years, the Australian government has refused to budge on the fate of these refugees. What has become of our moral compass that we should treat the most vulnerable amongst us, our children, in this way and consider it acceptable? I keep thinking that someone is going to be apologising for this in 20 years' time. But it will be too late for these kids. We need to get them off now. These children are being forced to grow up without the very basics that Australian parents consider necessities for their own sons and daughters, like a decent education. Only 15% are believed to be attending school due to risk of bullying. They're growing up without extended family. But most devastating to their well-being, their innocence has been taken. One of the things, it is a big responsibility, but one of the things I like about my new job, although it's probably not that new, is I get to make a difference, or at least try to. So we decided to see if we could do something more than just an article, something that would be a real game changer for the forgotten children of Nauru. And because this is bigger than us, and because we believe that most Australians would agree that children shouldn't be left to suffer and languish on an island prison, we decided to approach others in the sector and brought a group together under the hashtag Kids Off Nauru. It's really a campaign for and by all decent Australians who are heartbroken that we are denying these children their most fundamental rights, their freedom and their future. As of last night, we had nearly 30,000 people signed up to the campaign, and some great momentum amongst the political leaders who are starting to come out and speak to say that we should be resolving this. If our principles like equality, justice, freedom do not have the power or the agency to shape our policies and practices, then what do they mean? We must find a humane solution to this if our principles mean anything at all. And I know that we are a clever and creative country. If we want to do this, we can. So why are we here at this prayer breakfast? Why do we hold these kinds of events? One very good reason is for community. Because at times we can feel that our faith is under threat. And when our faith is under threat, freedom is under threat. The connection is very clear in my mind. But veteran Christian social commentator Oz Guinness says it much better than me. He believes that free societies like ours are rare and fleeting. He says that if you pack all of human history into 1 hour, free societies make a guest appearance for about 5 minutes. Because we've known freedom, we think it will always be here. We don't take seriously enough the need to protect it. Guinness argues that the freedom we know and understand in the West is grounded in Christian values. And with the exit of these Christian values from our institutions, we are putting our freedom at risk. We are becoming what he calls a cut flower civilization. Cut flowers in a vase don't last like flowers rooted in the soil. Historically speaking, nations corrupt their customs when they are at the pinnacle of their power or the height of prosperity, just like we are now. Why is that? Because people grow complacent. The foundation for free will and moral equality that underpins our society is laid out in the New Testament. They were taught by Jesus Christ and developed in the writings of Paul, such as the central teaching that regardless of apparently worldly inequalities, we are equal in the eyes of God. As Jen read for us and Paul explained in Galatians, There is neither Jew nor Greek. There is neither slave nor free. There is neither male nor female. For you are all one in Christ Jesus. And church leaders got this over the history of time. Christianity began in a world where almost half the population was in bondage. By the 7th century, Christianity was the only major world religion that was theologically opposed to slavery. But it took until the 18th century for Christian leaders like William Wilberforce and others to lead the abolition movement. This is a profound example of where privilege spoke of equality but did not live it until Wilberforce had the courage to stand up against conventional thinking. These values of free will and equality are so deep in our culture that we take them for granted. But we must defend freedom in practice, or else it can disintegrate into mere hedonism, licentiousness, and complacency. So this morning, let's take courage and stand on the strength of God's principles for restoration and redemption. That is why I am advocating for the children on Nauru. In this beautiful, messy, tumultuous world that we share with the poorest and the richest, I call on you, Tasmanian Christians and leaders, to live out the calling of Christ, to accept the restorative power of Jesus' gift of equality to all, and to do three things. One, reflect deeply on your privilege and where you might be inadvertently creating unjust outcomes. Two, remember that our freedom comes in part from our privilege and needs to be defended. How will you ensure that equitable freedom and grace for all will be protected in your spheres of influence? And three, I'd love you to join with me in using our privilege to challenge the decision makers to ensure the health and well-being of these suffering children on Nauru. Thank you for the opportunity to share my personal story with you today. And I pray that God will stir in your hearts as you fulfill your calling to use your privilege wisely.
Thank you. Thank you, Claire. And thank you for that challenge this morning. May we all take it.